Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute, live from the new WBAI studios, a socialist radio show and podcast from members of New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 70,000 members nationwide, and NYCDSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 5,500-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. For today's episode, the topic is, what is the New York City Council, and why is it important? What is NYCDSA? Why is NYCDSA focused on city council elections in 2021? How did we decide this? In this episode, we discuss our city's local legislative body and our chapter's yearly convention. During our 2019 convention, we democratically decided to focus on city council elections in 2021. In our 2020 convention, which took place remotely on Saturday, August 15th, to prevent the spread of COVID-19, we set our priorities for the next year. The resolutions and leadership elections that took place will affect how our chapter operates and our strategy for 2021 elections and the years to come. 35 of the 51 seats on the City Council will be open in 2021 due to term limits, giving New Yorkers a rare chance to send a strong message about what we want for our city. NYCDSA will be assembling a powerful slate of working-class candidates who can provide a socialist vision for New York City. But first, the headlines.
City Council Speaker Corey Johnson disproportionately slashed funding in council districts whose council members voted against last month's NYPD-friendly budget. NYCDSA endorsed State Senator Julia Salazar and Bushwick activist and City Council candidate Sandy Nurse condemned the maneuver on social media, pointing out that members who voted in favor of the budget received seven times more funding than those who voted against it. Fallout from the budget fight continues to highlight a disconnect between several Black members of City Council and community demands for police abolition. Long held as the mayoral frontrunner, Council Speaker Corey Johnson now faces challenges for members of both the left and right dissatisfied with the budget deal. The Police Benevolent Association, NYPD's largest union, formally endorsed Donald Trump for president. State court officials extended a freeze on residential evictions to October 1st. However, the 200,000 cases filed before the freeze began have resumed in court. New York City's School Principals Union is demanding the mayor to delay in-person instruction for a few weeks to allow schools to adequately assess how to safely reopen. After council member Carlos Menchaca of District 38 in Sunset Park publicly stated his opposition to the industry city rezoning in his district, several real estate-aligned council members from other boroughs announced that they would still support the plan. If the rezoning is pushed through against Menchaca's will, it would end the long-standing practice of deference to local council members on rezoning votes. The State Health Department released a report on Friday evening critiquing the Safe Staffing for Quality Care Act, a bill proposed to reduce the nurse-to-patient ratio in New York State. The New York State Nurses Association released a statement questioning the report's last-minute release and neglecting the role of understaffing in the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Activists held a Beds Not Body Bags demonstration outside Elmhurst Hospital in Queens to demand a restoration of the hospital bed capacity that has been slashed in the last two decades, disproportionately harming residents of outer boroughs and communities of color. NYCDSA endorsed State Senator Julia Salazar of District 18 in Bushwick and presumptive State Senator-elect Jabari Brisport in District 25 of Bed-Stuy, joined Gotham Gazette's podcast to discuss school reopenings, COVID-19, and the eviction crisis. And in election news, the recent string of victories by left-wing challengers doesn't bode well for Congressman Hakeem Jeffries of New York 8, Brooklyn. Democratic state senators have a prime opportunity to take several western New York seats from Republicans in November's election and could potentially win a supermajority in the chamber. The AFL-CIO endorsed Democrats in four open seats in the Rochester and Buffalo areas, but also endorsed a slate of Republican incumbents across the rest of the region. Councilmember Andrew Cohen of District 11 in Riverdale and Woodlawn is leaving his seat to become a judge. Five candidates are competing in a special election to replace him. And finally, a crowded field of candidates are vying to succeed term-limited Councilmember Margaret Shin of District 1 in Lower Manhattan, including her former chief of staff and a challenger who narrowly lost a primary fight in 2017.
Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group, covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc. Hello and welcome. My name is Michael Thomas Carter. My pronouns are he, him, and his, and I'll be hosting this episode. I'm a writer, organizer, and activist with NYC DSA. I started organizing at Columbia University with Student Worker Solidarity, then went on to work for Bernie 2016 as a field organizer in New York City and Los Angeles. In 2018, I joined Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's historic primary campaign for Congress as her second full-time staffer. In the campaign, I worked as fundraising director, field director, and deputy campaign manager. From 2018 to 2020, I worked for State Senator Julia Salazar as her communications director. I was also co-campaign manager for her re-election campaign, which won over 80% of the Democratic primary vote. In this show, I'll be covering the happenings at our chapter's annual convention, which took place this Saturday, and their relationship to NYC DSA's electoral strategy moving forward. The future of New York City substantially depends on the 2021 elections, which will be decided in practice by the Democratic primaries on June 22nd, 2020. Not only will New Yorkers elect a new mayor, city comptroller, and borough district attorneys, we will also have the opportunity to fill 35 open city council seats, over 65% of the total. Not only that, but this will be the first city election with ranked choice voting, a voting method that could have unpredictable effects on the results. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in NYC, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking about the NYC DSA convention, but first, fundraising pitch. I love the freedom that I have as a producer on WBAI to discuss theoretical concepts, to get into it about civics and about government, and give voice to the minds and hearts of activists. I don't have to worry about selling things, pleasing a corporate sponsor, or properly thanking a foundation for their support. But creating this environment is not free. Our engineers and staff need a fair wage. We have to pay rent to our station space and for the transmitter. Donating to the station, whether on a monthly or one-time basis, helps cover these costs and make programs like Revolutions Per Minute possible. If you become a BAI buddy, we will be glad to thank you on air for your support. To give to the station, please call 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602, or go to WBAI.org. Thank you. The New York City Democratic Socialists of America held our annual convention this Saturday, August 15th. Originally, it was scheduled for March 14th, 2020, as an in-person gathering, but was postponed and made remote due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The proposals that were discussed on Saturday were the result of a long process of collective debate and organizing within our chapter. NYC DSA has branches for South Brooklyn, Central Brooklyn, North Brooklyn, Lower Manhattan, Bronx/Upper Manhattan, Queens, and Staten Island. Each of these branches elected delegates to represent them at our convention, and these delegates voted on the proposals. These delegates voted to approve our general tasks and perspectives resolution, a resolution to hold at least two fundraisers per year for Youth DSA, a resolution to improve issue-based working groups' coordination with leadership, a resolution to codify the existing practices of the Electoral Working Group, a resolution to require 3 months of membership in order to vote in electoral endorsement decisions, and a resolution to codify our 2021 endorsement process. One resolution, which sought to prevent elected officials from serving as citywide leadership, received a majority of votes, but did not pass the required 60% threshold and therefore did not pass. In addition, delegates voted for Comrade Claire Valdez to become the membership coordinator of the chapter. She will be succeeding Comrade Marvin Gonzalez in that role. The keynote speaker, Professor Kianga Yamada Taylor, is a socialist, an assistant professor at Princeton University, and a writer and speaker on Black politics, social movements, and racial inequality in the United States. Kianga is a former contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and is currently a contributing writer at the New Yorker. Her writing has appeared in the Paris Review, Guardian, The Nation, and Jacobin, among others. Her most recent book is Race for Profit, How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Home Ownership, was published in 2019, and her earlier book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, is a deep analysis of the first Black Lives Matter mobilization and one of the sharpest critiques of the Obama era. She's also editor of How We Get Free, Black Feminism and the Combahee River Collective. There are few people to help us understand our situation as socialists after this tumultuous year, defined by Bernie's campaign, COVID-19, and the upsurge for racial justice. Here's a short excerpt of her remarks.
Hunger abounds, homelessness for millions rests on the horizon, and a U.S. Congress where the average member of the House of Representatives is worth $1 million in net wealth, and a typical U.S. senator is worth $3 million, simply leave on recess without appropriating any funds to cushion the crisis, to cushion a crisis that has been made worse by their consistent neglect as a body. We know that the American billionaire class has become $583 billion richer since the onset of the virus, while millions of ordinary people have lost healthcare, housing, jobs, and any sense of security. We have also seen how the crises in political economy are tightly wound to and in many cases exacerbated by the racism, nationalism, xenophobia, misogyny, and unadulterated human hatred that is conjured and deployed to undermine solidarity at a time when it has never been more necessary. For the elite, they know that unbridled racism is necessary to hold on to what they have and to divide those who have every interest in coming together. From the manufactured crisis on the border and the way that Trump has used this health crisis to make real his efforts to end migration across the southern border into the country, to the right's predictable rage about Black Lives Matter as they attempt to discredit the movement while legitimizing the racism that has brought it to life in the first place, the long entwined relationship with race and class in the United States has never been more alive. These inequities always exist, but they are usually buried beneath the surface of our society. The pandemic and then the uprisings have roiled our society in such ways as to bring the bottom to the top, making these contradictions visible to everyone and in fact inescapable. The effect of this has been to show in practice the complicated ways in which our lives and ultimately our fates are connected. It has exposed the plutocrats for the leeches that they are and removed all the rhetoric about hard work being the difference between them and the rest of us. Meanwhile, the hard work of those most disrespected in our society, the so-called essential workers who are disproportionately women and of color, have demonstrated that their poverty and marginalization is not caused by a lack of hard work and commitment, but because of economic and financial exploitation where the rich live better because of their ability to pay essential workers less than they are worth. Uncovering this fundamentally unfair arrangement erupted into the consciousness of mainstream society 10 years ago with the advent of the Occupy movement. But with each passing year, as wages stand still while inflation and the cost of living rise, the conflict becomes infuriating, radicalizing. The realization among millions has laid the foundation for a genuine resistance to the status quo we face today. We see it all around us. The explosion of Occupy and the emergence of the movement in Ferguson to the Baltimore Rebellion and the rise of Black Lives Matter, the Red State Rebellion and the Teacher Revolt, which helped to reestablish the public imagination, the universal right to a publicly financed public education, the reemergence of the Sanders campaign and the rise and growth of the Squad, democratically elected congresspeople have finally provided an electoral expression to the intense class anger that has been rising through mainstream society. We could see the constituent parts of this immediate organizing and potential of Amazon workers and other low-wage service workers as the ravages of the pandemic first took hold, and the willingness to risk everything in order to stand up for each other, and in doing so, really raising public awareness to the dangers that awaited millions who would come out of shelter in place mandates to return to work. Finally, the George Floyd uprising at the end of May and throughout the month of June showed what mass solidarity and struggle could look like. The New York Times has estimated that upwards of 26 million people in this country alone partook in a variety of street protests against racist police abuse and violence. But those protests quickly generalized beyond the issues of police brutality, just as the Black Lives Matter movement in 2014 and 2016 had done previously. Police violence was so closely wound to the litany of abuses, oppression, and degradation in the lives of ordinary Black people in particular.
So you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in NYC, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. That was just Kianga Yamada Taylor, an academic and prominent socialist who was invited to speak at the New York City DSA convention. That was an excerpt of her remarks. If you'd like to hear more, perhaps join New York City DSA at socialist.nyc. So I did want to talk about a little bit this kind of radical anti-capitalist rhetoric, this kind of just speech, this truth to power. The even for someone who's more established, like Professor Taylor, is not super welcomed in the media space, whether it's the corporate media space and even some of the nonprofit media space. So really the lifeblood of being able to do this work is donating to the station, whether it's on a monthly or one-time basis. That helps us cover costs and makes programs like Revolutions Per Minute possible. If you become a BAI buddy, we'll be glad to thank you on air for your support. To give onto the station, please call 516-620-3602. Again, that's 516-620-3602, or go to WBAI.org. Thank you. So, we've seen these problems. We've heard about them from this person, from this incredibly accomplished academic who really broke down very well the situation that we're facing. And now I'm going to go to a much from the 30,000 feet view to a much more local view, and that's about city council. So what is city council and why is it important? During our 2019 convention, DSA voted to focus on the 2021 city council elections by recruiting and running member organizers who would be a good fit to represent their communities. New York City has 51 city council members, each of whom represent a district of several hundred thousand constituents. The current breakdown of the council is 48 Democrats and 3 Republicans with 1 vacant seat. So unlike in some legislative bodies, it's not so easy to know just because somebody has a D next to their name, just because they're a member of the blue team, does not mean that they are representing our communities or that they will represent what the people have shown that they need through this crisis. Several city council members are members of the Democratic Socialists of America, but our chapter has not endorsed a city council campaign since the 2017 cycle, when we endorsed Jabari Brisport in his first run for office. Additionally, council member Inez Barron identifies as a socialist who comes out of the Black Panther Party movement and represents East New York, but she has no affiliation with NYC DSA. Traditionally, the speaker of the city council, who is currently Corey Johnson, has a lot of power over what bills can come to the floor and the level of funding available for individual districts. New Yorkers saw this dynamic play out in the recent campaign to defund the NYPD as part of the George Floyd uprising. which largely revolved around the annual passage of the New York City budget in June. The budget process usually begins with the mayor's draft budget, then is negotiated with the council speaker, who must whip the votes of the members to obtain their votes. NYC DSA participated in a broad coalition of community organizations and activists that set up the City Hall encampment, which occupied space and demanded at least a 50% cut to the NYPD's $6 billion budget. Some of the leaders of that coalition were Vocal New York and Communities United for Police Reform, as well as countless individuals in the street who knew exactly what they wanted and required no permission from any nonprofit, any organization, any kind of elected official to come forth and to talk about what they demand. The final deal for the budget cost $94.4 billion, but it unfortunately, it fell far short of the coalition's demands and included no reduction in NYPD headcount. In addition, an analysis of the budget by the NY Daily News showed that after the budget vote, Corey Johnson gave the 17 no votes an average of 7 times less discretionary and capital funding than the 30 yes votes. That discretionary and capital funding goes towards local projects in council members' districts, things like repairing a school or a swimming pool or funding a local nonprofit or direct service organization that houses the homeless. And so having this kind of transactionalism with this really crucial source of funding really shows how much control and power that the speaker has, even over our community's ability to live day to day. This outcome points towards the importance of the 2021 elections, as any attempt to restrain, defund, or even reform the New York City Police Department must run through the City Council. In addition, the New York City Council has a tradition of deferring to council members representing a community that is in danger of a rezoning. This means that if we can get enough City Council members elected, we can help protect our city from predatory real estate developers and their enablers in government by blocking future predatory developments and demanding real affordable housing through community land trusts, renewed public housing, and funding for nonprofits. Finally, the discretionary and capital funding I mentioned earlier that council members can distribute to their district is very small compared to the total size of the budget. Remember, $94 billion, but important for building on-the-ground spaces for community organizing, keeping important advocacy and direct service organizations from closing their doors, and fixing basic capital needs in our city that are left by failures at other levels of government. While we reject the transactional politics shown by Speaker Johnson in his behavior, if we had a significant block of socialist city council members, we could take that discretionary funding and use it to actually meet community needs. So, speaking of enablers of predatory capitalism in government, our NYC DSA chapter co-chair, Chiyanunwa, had a very relevant question for Kianga Yamada Taylor after her remarks during the convention.
NYC DSA, especially after getting involved in the Defund the NYPD campaign, has faced a lot of accusations from various figures in the Black political establishment in New York that we're racist for pursuing this campaign, that we're just a bunch of white gentrifiers, that this movement doesn't really represent people of color. So in your view, how would you respond to charges of racism, like the ones I just described from the Black political establishment?
I mean, I think, you know, these are people who are gatekeepers, who are, you know, trying to maintain their own positions. And when you look at the political platforms and agendas of a Jamal Bowman or Cori Bush, these are policies that resonate deeply among working class Black people. They're policies that, if implemented, would radically transform the lives of ordinary Black people. And, you know, I think that the kind of way that people have a lot of these Black establishment figures have ingratiated themselves into the institutions and offices that really manage and oversee the oppression of ordinary Black people, you know, has tied them to those practices. And, you know, I think that at the end of the day, the success of these campaigns, I think, speaks to the deep desire that people want things done differently, that they want different kinds of political representatives that actually match with the aspirations that they have for, you know, a different for a different approach, you know, that could alleviate the issues with poverty and underemployment and all those things. And so, you know, it's just the kind of most basic and simplistic response of, you know, people who have been entrenched in these positions and have had delivered very little to respond in that way. And ultimately, you know, I guess on some level, the voters will decide, you know, who is not racist, but who represents a racist agenda, you know, who represents the racist status quo. They'll be the ones who ultimately make that determination. So I wrote some about this in the, not in New York in particular, but in a thing I wrote called The End of Black Politics, and the class dynamics in Black communities, and, you know, some of the nefarious roles that some of these Black elected officials have played, and that, you know, 50 years is long enough of just holding up representation, but with no commitment to a political program that can actually improve the lives of working class Black people, you know, and people are going to vote with their feet.
And they have been. I think that she really ably broke down the relationship between race and class in our movement. I think a really good example of this kind of turnover of African-American leadership in the city is the recent election results from NYC DSA and from, you know, many other groups that came up and said that same old is not enough, that there have been faces that are representative in high places for, at this point, a long time that have not achieved the results that the people require. I think two figures that are a really good example of this are Tremaine Wright versus Farrah Souffrant Forrest. Tremaine Wright is a landlord. She is a longtime political candidate. She was an assemblywoman, and then she left her seat in order to run for the seat that was just vacated by Velmanette Montgomery. Velmanette Montgomery has a really strong record of advocating for her community. She was really early on about legalizing marijuana, for example, and other really important criminal justice issues. But regardless, she gave her endorsement to Tremaine Wright, who had the support of the Brooklyn Democratic Party, had the support of the existing machine, and was in general not a strong supporter of tenants' rights, not a strong supporter of the working class. And she ran in the Senate race that our member, Jabari Brisport, ended up winning. She was supposed to be the winner, according to the machine, and at one point, she would have won. But those days are over. Right now in New York, you don't just have to go to 10 people, ask them for their blessing, and then become the next council member, become the next congressperson, become the next assembly person. You need to go directly to the electorate, directly to the people, and ask them what they want. And that's a really good example with Farah Souffrant Forest. Farah is Haitian American. She's a nurse. She's very working class. She was working on the COVID pandemic while she was running on a platform of alleviating the problems of the COVID pandemic. So she knows what it's like on a day-to-day level to deal with these issues. I believe she's a tenant. And her race was successful. She managed to defeat a longtime incumbent, Walter Mosley, who also has participated in the gentrification of his own community. And so I think right now it would be a good time. I'd love to open up the phone lines. We have, I don't know, around 20, 25 minutes left. And I just ask, so what do you think of, there's no more listener phone calls? It's impossible. All right. Cool. All right, it's Plan B, baby. So, with the council elections, one of the other aspects of electing local representatives that I think is sometimes underappreciated is the staff aspect. Each legislator on each level has a certain staff allocation that they can use to hire people who will carry out their vision. And so there's a bunch of different kinds of people that they might hire. There's communications folks who would talk about their agenda, send out emails, send out mailers, try to kind of bring the electeds' influence out into the community. You have constituent service folks who basically are there to take on the front lines of our social crisis. I mean, you have a lot of people coming into their local legislators' offices with huge problems and problems that to some extent you can alleviate, but are really hard to fully deal with without legislation. But regardless of that, so many people out there, they just want somebody to listen to them. They want somebody to commiserate, to have a real person on the phone, to be able to say, here are your options. These are the services available to you. Because I can say from personal experience, I personally have not always known the services available to me as a citizen in New York City. And I've been in the situation multiple times of saying, hey, there's this grant you can get. Hey, you should apply for the housing lottery. Hey, this is how to apply for unemployment. And it's important to realize that so many people out there have no idea how to access these services. And so they go through life or parts of their lives without achieving the help that they are entitled to. And that's sort of what a constituent service staffer does. They say, okay, these are your circumstances. This is your social security. This is your disability benefit. This is how I can help you make that better. And it's an important thing to think about also, because a lot of our official statistics don't capture those people. They don't capture somebody who's got such a mental illness problem that they aren't able to access the 15-page government form that it requires to get the aid that they deserve. And so, you know, these new legislators that are coming into Albany have a big job in front of them. They need to go from and then these are all kind of relatively shortchanged districts. If you're talking on the state level, Brooklyn in particular, other communities of color have been systematically just defunded and disenfranchised by the system in Albany. You can even go, it's as basic as school funding. There are millions of dollars owed to schools, mostly populated by Black and Brown kids, that just have not been dispersed, and the governor does not intend on dispersing them with any kind of timeline. But let's talk a little more about on the city level what can be done. Because we already talked about Corey Johnson. We talked about the speaker, how much power exists in that office, and what can we even do? Let's say, now the cool thing, and one of the reasons why we
sort of said that 2021 was so important for us is that 65%, which is the number of seats that are open, is a super majority. So even if the council were to pass something and the mayor were to not be excited about it and try to veto it, the council would actually be able to override that if we had that number. Now, that's unlikely that we would be able to elect that many democratic socialists in one fell swoop. But even if you would get halfway there or a quarter of the way there, that could really endanger the sort of power dynamic. Because as I said towards the beginning of the show, there are 48 Democrats on this city council. This whole movement, this George Floyd movement, this movement to defund the police, it runs through Democratic cities. It's like in Minneapolis, which is actually my hometown. I mean, the city council were the ones who led in saying, we want to abolish the Minneapolis Police Department. We want to create something that can replace it, that can take on the essential functions that it may do while avoiding the disproportionate harms that it visits upon the Black community in Minneapolis. We're far from that here in New York. And I don't want to say also that that will necessarily turn out that way in Minneapolis, because the forces of reaction are always ready to come back and kind of make it so that even the greatest victory is two steps forward, one step back. But the city council, and they have a relatively left-wing city council, even compared to ours, they have a Green Party member, for example, is where those kind of decisions get made. Austin did a similar thing and significantly defunded its police department. Here in New York, it's a little bit fuzzy, because while the mayor and the speaker have said that they have defunded to the tune of $1 billion, the advocacy groups contend, and I personally agree, that really it constituted more of a shuffling around of the funding. And because it doesn't entail any kind of drop in head count, you can't really argue that it's a $1 billion cut. It is hundreds of millions of dollars, and that's a testament to all of the action in the street and all of the people who stood up and said that enough was enough. I was, you know, unfortunately, but also, I don't know. I mean, it was a formative experience in my life. I actually went out to observe a protest to film it with my smartphone, you know, because as we've seen, all of these deaths of protesters or hurt protesters or deaths of suspected perpetrators, it's the smartphones that have proliferated that allow us to substantiate what has been going on for generations. I would encourage anyone who doesn't think that this has been going on for generations to check out an essay by James Baldwin about the police in Harlem, the Harlem of his era. And it's truly horrifying to see him just write about what his community has had to endure. And in a time well before Twitter, well before all of these methods that we now have to sort of coordinate as a population, and how much they got away with. I think it was like it's just horrible. And it's never been rectified. The last time we had a curfew in this city was because a white cop got into a fight with an African-American soldier, and the soldier shot the cop. And it was similar. It has been used and will continue to be used as a tool to maintain the white power structure and the white supremacist state. So with that, I just went off for a second. When I went out to take a photo of the police who were dealing with protesters on my block, I was actually chased, beaten, and arrested, brought to 120 Schermerhorn downtown Brooklyn, and that without any sort of explanation of my crime, I guess it was curfew, it was just a pure method of intimidation, and that's really all they have. I think you can see that with the recent, as the headlines say, Police Benevolent Association's endorsement of Donald Trump. They've made it clear that at least in terms of their institutions and the people who are supposed to represent them, that they are supportive of the fascist turn in our government and in our society. That is one of the things about the NYPD that sort of scares me the most. It's 33,000 people under arms, and it's run by the most hidebound reactionaries among them. They'll often point to diversity statistics, but if you look a little bit closer, most of the high-ranking officers in the NYPD are the white officers in the NYPD because of the way that seniority works. So, you know, there were several NYPD sources talking about, oh, well, if you cut our budget, we'll be forced to be less diverse because we have to fire the people of color first, which I think is just such a completely backwards, I mean, it's a threat, honestly, and that's all they have, in my opinion. So with the, that is something that in terms of city council can be rectified. So I do want to, though, give a caveat in that it's important that the city and the state are intersecting because, there's something called the Erstat law, which means that New York City has less leeway than some other cities do in terms of setting its own tax rates and managing its own budget. So in order to raise taxes, they have to, de Blasio would have to go to Albany. But because of our recent victories of our slate, we're now in a better position if we can have city council folks and state senate and state assembly folks together. That is the only way we can bring lasting change to this city. And that's been used before, that strategy of Albany and city together. Most nefariously effectively, but very nefariously by, Robert Moses in the 20th century. He had a close relationship with both the mayor Al Smith and Governor Roosevelt, or the governor when Al Smith was there. He wrote a lot of the legislation, actually, that the senators didn't quite read, that gave him almost dictatorial power over the Parks Department and over land use decisions in the city. And that's where it all comes down to. In my opinion, it's land value. You can see that in the Brooklyn-Queens connector debate, which is very much surrounding, yes, transit between Brooklyn and Queens, which needs to improve, but also increasing real estate values of politically connected donors who have waterfront property that will get more valuable as there is a rail link in that area. And, you know, that's really why I think the aspect of the city council, rezoning responsibility is very important because, there is this tradition of deferring to the local council member. I remember I used to work uptown in Inwood for the then state senator up there. And the big controversy was the Inwood rezoning, which now is sort of legally in limbo. But what I saw was the local council member, his name's Idonis Rodriguez. He knew that he was about to leave office, right? He had term limits. It wasn't like he was going, he was trying out different things in terms of running for public advocate. I believe he ran for one other office, but it looked like he was leaving his council position. But he still felt this intense pressure from the surrounding political and financial forces to allow this rezoning to happen. Even though it was sort of very unpopular in terms of whenever any community input was solicited, it was almost uniformly negative. Now, since then, that whole thing has been, it's in appellate court right now. That may or may not go through. But we would have been able to prevent that if we had had a socialist, anti-capitalist, pro-tenant person in there at the time. So yeah, the level to which the city council is important, especially in an all democratic city council, it's almost as if these folks expect that they will have their positions until they either have the term limits or they die of old age or they retire. And that's been the case in the past. You know, when you look at somebody like Chuck Schumer, he is a product of this classic political system. He became an assemblyman at something like age 25. And throughout his career, he kept his head down. He spoke to what were then the right people, to the machines, to the Brooklyn machine, to the Manhattan machine, the Bronx machine, the Queens machine. And as a result, at every mode, even though I don't think anyone would argue that Mr. Schumer is a scintillating speaker or compelling or has a compelling biography, he is now the Senate Majority Leader as a result of that. Now, what's going to be interesting is seeing in this future era, in this era where there is much more of a direct connection between voters and the elected official, what does the leader of the Senate Democrats in 20 years or 30 years look like? Is it going to be somebody more like Alexandria? Somebody who, you know, you can always tweet at her and think maybe she'll read it. Whereas if you tweet at Chuck Schumer, you know for a fact that a communications staffer might read it and that he doesn't have any idea what's going on his Twitter. So that is, I thought now I could talk a little bit about what the strategy is and why the strategy is connected to the politics. We here in New York City DSA have really focused on building robust, strong field operations. And so as a former electoral worker, what that means is direct contact with voters. So that's you call people, you text people, you knock on their door, you might try to run into them at a busy intersection or a subway spot or something like that. And the thing about these kinds of operations are you can only really mobilize volunteers, at least in my experience, but I think it does carry forward. You can only really mobilize volunteers for a cause that inspires them or for a cause that is directly related to their well-being or even their monetary profit. So for an establishment politician, the kind of volunteers that you can get are like staffers who are off one day and are from another member of the machine's politicians. They could be nonprofit executives who want to receive some of that discretionary funding that we talked about earlier. They could be interns who want to have a line on their resume and be able to kind of get into the back rooms of politics. There aren't as many sort of strongly ideologically motivated people or strongly materially motivated people who might more literally depend on the result of the election. Now, what we've managed to do in DSA is basically take a bunch of tasks that traditionally are the domain of a small cadre of political consultants who take a lot of corporate money and kind of use it in order to get candidates. And then those candidates are somewhat beholden to those consultants. We've taken a lot of the work that they do, which previously was seen as sort of arcane and unknowable, and we've given it to volunteers. We've trained folks in how to use Vote Builder, the Democratic Party software for voting. We've trained folks in how to phone bank. We've trained folks in how to canvass, even people who are very shy and don't really want to have become champion canvassers. And because we bring people in, because we ask for their input, and because we have a message that they believe in, we've been growing as a result. And our capability is growing as a result. And, you know, the funny thing about it is there isn't a secret. It's all public. We are very public about the strategy that we are using, because it doesn't rely on cloak and dagger. It doesn't rely on kind of a back room or the proverbial cigar smoke. It's about being straight up, saying to people, wouldn't this policy have improved your life? And are you willing to spend an hour of your time to improve it? And in some cases, it's also, you know, maybe it won't directly improve your life, but maybe you, this is a radical idea in the United States, but maybe you want to improve someone else's life, even if you can't benefit. So, and that's something that I think is really important with the establishment narrative about DSA. A lot of folks, you know, as she talked about and as Kiyanga broke down, a lot of people in the political establishment see us as a political movement of gentrifiers. And in some cases, that may be true. However, it's confusing because are people who move to a neighborhood supposed to involve themselves with the politics and with the community of that neighborhood, or are they not? Because it's deeply ironic, because many of these same politicians who decry the influence of gentrifiers on politics created the conditions to bring the gentrifiers in the first place. If you're gonna be a real estate backed politician in New York and you're gonna advocate for something like Hudson Yards or something like the rezoning of downtown Brooklyn, you are directly causing this group of people to enter into your district. And then when you turn around and say, oh, well, they shouldn't get involved, they're not from here, it's very ironic. And it's sort of like they have been hoisted by their own petard, as you say. And I think that's generally true, too, of the establishment in New York, because one of the things that they've been doing for generations is keeping turnout low. And it is still pretty low. We've been increasing it bit by bit. But the thing is, the machine has forgotten, by and large, how to turn out votes. They haven't had to in a long time because they could rely on the system of different funders and party functionaries that kept the whole system rolling. They didn't need to, for instance, increase turnout. They would rather have it low. They would rather have you not pay attention. They would rather have you be a passive observer and not an active participant. So that, though, it appears, hopefully crossing fingers, that kind of politics is ending. And if you're listening and you want to get involved in politics and you don't really know what that means or which side you should join or sort of what any of this means, I would encourage you to join NYC DSA. Visit socialist.nyc to find an upcoming virtual meeting.